WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
You are listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Today, we're kicking things off with a fun, candid conversation with a living Broadway legend. Before Harvey Fierstein was a four-time Tony Award winner, before he was Edna Turnblad or Tevye or Arnold Beckoff, he was a gay Jewish kid growing up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn. Harvey recognized from a young age that his feelings about his gender and sexuality were quite different from those around him. He also recognized, after a stint at art school, that his real passion was for the stage. So he cut his teeth in off-off-Broadway productions, becoming a regular at La Mama, making no money, until his groundbreaking series of plays about a gay Jewish drag queen became a huge hit. Torch Song Trilogy catapulted Harvey to Broadway and earned him 2 Tony Awards. And he's been making and starring in hit shows ever since. Harvey tells the story of his life and career in his New York Times bestselling memoir, I Was Better Last Night, which was also our March Get Lit with All of It book club selection. We were thrilled that Harvey Fierstein also joined us to kick off our return to in-person Get Lit events. We spent an evening with Harvey at the New York Public Library event space at the SNFL Center in front of a live audience of book lovers. It was so great to see so many of you back in person after 2 years of being virtual. So during this interview, you will hear applause, laughter, and one woman from Harvey's past who surprises him at the event. You won't want to miss that. We also have to mention that Harvey has a very special way with words, especially one that starts with F, many of which we had to bleep in the broadcast. With all of that in mind, please enjoy these highlights from our Get Lit event with Harvey Fierstein. How did you go about writing this memoir?
There was this thing called the pandemic. Did you hear about that?
It's something.
Yeah. So everything got canceled all of a sudden. So I went up to my office and I cleared the desk. I did everything that was on my desk. And there was still a pandemic. So I got out my sewing machine. I make quilts, as you may know if you read the book. And there will be a test later. And so I got out the sewing machine because people have had babies, they got married, whatever. I owed some quilts. So I made 5 quilts in a row, which would usually be like 3 years' work for me. But there was a... Did you hear about the pandemic? So I made 5 quilts, and I even made 2 more tops. But, you know, I ran out of bottoms. Anyway.
I knew it was coming. You knew it was coming.
No, but that's the title of my next book. I thought I'd write a book about my boyfriends, and I thought I would call it Bottomless. But anyway, so I finished that, and then my agent said to me, "Have you ever thought of writing a memoir?" And I said, "I don't really write in that format. I write op-ed pieces." But I'm very dyslexic, and which is the reason that I started reading plays and all that, because they didn't have all that boring description. Mm-hmm. You know, they just got right to the meat of it. And nobody's going to see it, right? So I turned on the computer, and I wrote the first story that's actually not the preface, but the first chapter in the book about being in second grade and wanting, and they made me the king in Sleeping Beauty, and I wanted to be the evil witch. But Philomena Morano got that role. And so I wrote that story, and I said, I wonder if everybody would give a flying. So I sent it to Philomena, because we're still friends. We've been friends since kindergarten. In fact, an hour ago, an hour and a half ago, I had water with somebody in the reading room downstairs that I haven't seen since fifth grade.
Wow.
So that was a friend of Philomena's and mine. I don't let people go unless they die on me. Then I let them go because they smell. If you don't let them go, they do. They smell. So I sent it to Philomena, and she sent back the photograph that's in the book of me in drag at 7 years old. And I said, if she saved that photograph all these years, then it must mean something to her. If it means something to her, maybe it would mean something to some. Yeah. And so I continued to write.
Now, you and your brother, Ron, are very close. He handles your business and your legal affairs.
And tells me I'm wrong.
Well, you need that person in your life, don't you, in showbiz?
Yeah, sure.
You may not like it, but you need it.
Yeah, sure.
You guys have pronounced your last names differently.
Yes. Everyone in my family does.
Yes. I think that's so interesting. Will you explain why?
I will. So here's the deal. My father was brought up in an orphanage in Ellenville, New York. His mother died in childbirth. So his father was the town barber, and men didn't raise babies in those days. So he was put into an orphanage. And he always had a chip on his shoulder that they took his sister in, relatives did, but nobody wanted him. So he ended up living the first 13 years of his life mm-hmm. in an orphanage. And of course, 13 is when you're an adult and can take care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And at 13 years old, he got a job driving a bakery truck, and he was an adult, and that was that. So the name was Firestein. That's the way he pronounced it. We know, because we have his grandfather's shaving mug, that the name was originally Feuerstein, F-E-U-E-R, like that actor Mark Feuerstein, who swears it has no relationship to me. I told him it doesn't make you gay. But he said, we're not related. Get away from me. So my father pronounced it Feuerstein. So it seems to me it was his name. Let's pronounce it Firestein. But no. My mother, the librarian, decided that it was F-I-E-R and S-T-E-I-N, Feuerstein. Feuerstein. That's the right pronunciation. So Mr. Firestein married Mrs. Feuerstein. Then my brother came along. I don't know why, but he became Feuerstein. So now, when my brother and I go to business meetings, we're introduced as Mr. Firestein and Mr. Feuerstein, and people say, oh, I thought you were brothers. I was winning because of my career and fame, but he went, the dirty bastard, and had two sons, and they've had kids. So now they're five against me. So there's five pronouncing it Feuerstein, Dean, I think. I don't know. Look it up in the book. Anyway, I'm losing that war. But anyway, so there's absolutely no real reason why. No reason at all. Absolutely none. That's the way it is.
That's one of those interesting things we learn in the book that people don't know about you. Another is that you went to Pratt. You went to art school.
Mm-hmm. Are there Pratt people here, too? Oh, is it? Pratty right here. Yes, I went to Pratt. The art and design taught me to love art. Pratt taught me to hate it. And Pratt asks me for money every single week and asks me to join the alumni thing and all that, and I will have nothing to do with them because they took the love of art away from me. A bad teacher can do that. Mm-hmm. That is why we have to support good teachers. I loved nothing more than color until I had a color teacher. So I switched over to ceramics and had a, well, it's all in the book. But yes, I didn't think I was a great artist. Let's go backwards. In the 1950s, autistic was the word they used for, you know what I mean? Like in the 40s, it might have been sensitive. In the 50s, it was autistic. What's with your son? He's autistic. So I was sent that way. You know, my mother sent me to art school and stuff. And when I got into art school, she said, "Oh, we have him solved. We'll make him an artist." And I knew I was not a great artist by any means. But I knew that in the field of art, especially because of what we were taught in art and design. Art and design was a vocational school. Mm-hmm. I don't know that what it is now. It was a vocational school. We were taught to do paste-ups and lettering and all that stuff that we would make a living that is all done by computer now. But we were taught all that stuff so we could go out into the marketplace and make a living, which is the reason that Pratt hated us, because they wanted you to starve to death. It's a whole other thing. But so I always knew I could be in the art world, mm-hmm. and that's what I wanted to be. I had no interest in acting. I had no interest in writing. I was very dyslexic, and to be a writer, it seemed mm-hmm. absurd. I could barely read. And then life happens. If you want life to happen, which is my particular philosophy, if you live mm-hmm. your life in a way that says yes to new experiences, even stupid little ones. When people ask you to go for coffee or whatever, and you're sitting there going, "Oh, not today, you know, I'm reading my book." If you stay and you read your book, you may get that chapter finished. But if you go out for coffee, you don't know what the could happen. And that's what life for me was, for some reason that I don't really understand. People asked me to do things, and like an idiot, when other kids said no, I said yes. And I followed this very strange path.
There was almost the detour where you were a substitute teacher.
Yeah.
At one point.
Well, I was trying to fit in with a boyfriend. Mm. The guy that taught songs based on, he was a New York City school teacher, and at that time I was already in theater and all that. I was already acting and already writing and all that. But I thought if I taught also, I had my license to teach. I thought if I taught also and the two of us were on the same schedule, maybe the relationship would work better. But you can't change who you are for somebody else. I didn't know that then, but you just can't. But I tried. So I substitute taught for a little while. And what happened was I was at Art and Design, substitute teaching at Art and Design. And I walked in one morning, and the dean called me into his office, and there were other teachers standing around. I went, "Oh, did I sleep with any of them? Did I touch a kid wrong or something?" I'm like, they're all like staring at me. And what the dean said was that this one particular teacher just was went into the hospital and it needs an operation and will most likely not come back and or will retire, and we are offering you his class. So welcome to Art and Design as a full-time teacher. I went, "Holy shit. I better get the out of here." Because I could see my retirement ahead. I could see being 65 and I didn't even teach that day. I didn't even stay and sub that day. I just got out of it. And one of the teachers said to me, Mrs. Alden said, "We always knew of all of our students, you'd be the one to make it." And I went, "Oh, holy let me get out of here." So I ran as quickly as I could.
You have a remarkable recall of names. Has it always been?
That's funny, because I always think I don't remember names and I don't remember people. But that's probably the writer in me, because mm-hmm. I do remember the details of it. I mean, yeah, I all of our brains work so differently. Mm-hmm. But I don't remember names really easily, but I think the imprinted ones, the ones that are so inside you. Yeah. I mean, like old teachers, you know. Yeah. But those teachers, Max Ginsburg, as I said, showed up in Hartford, Connecticut the other day to see one of these book events. He was my painting teacher. And he heard me tell this story that I wasn't going to be a great artist or whatever. And he comes up to me after the thing and he said, "You were a great artist, Harvey." And I said, "Thank God he remembers nothing." It's so good. He just...
Wow. Do you remember the Dove Theater Company in St. Peter's Church and Natalie Rogers and Harold Herbst were the artistic directors. You were a little boy then. I mean, you were very, very young.
Don't tell me you're Natalie Rogers.
I'm Natalie.
Natalie, you're in the book. She's not going to be happy when she hears what she's in the book. Natalie, there's a big story about you. You're a very big part of my life, and you don't even know it.
God, we have to talk. I brought a book for you that I wrote.
Well, she hears this.
We're having an Only in New York moment. Go for it, Harvey.
Let me see if I can find it.
Oh, my God.
Natalie, there's a whole story about you in here. I swear. Madly, please forgive me. I'm going to tell the story, so please forgive me if it's different than you remember it. But it's in the book. Okay, so I go for an audition. I've done Pork with Andy Warhol at La Mama. I'm already a La Mama person, and then there's all these auditions for other shows, and I get this feeling there's this whole other world, this underground art world. And you know, it's like I'm going to school full time. I'm living like this triple life. I'm a nice Jewish boy at home. I'm going to school full time to be a teacher. And then at night, I'm in this sort of arty world. You know, it's like I just said in another interview, I go to school and the history of art teacher would lecture about Ray Johnson. Ray Johnson is now creating this new art movement called mail art, where he takes a postcard and he puts a picture on it and he mails it to another artist and they add something and they mail it to somebody else and around it goes, and you know, showing slides of mail art and all that. And that night I'm in bed with Ray going, you know, they gave a lecture about you tonight. It was a very different kind of life. So there was an audition at this theater called the Dove Company at the church. Oh, Natalie, please forgive me for telling this story. She's going to die. She's going to die. There's four of us lined up on the stage, and Natalie says, I want you to be a shirt. Okay. So I was standing there. She says, an ironed shirt. So I started like to make my arms stiff, and she says, are you a striped iron shirt or a plain iron shirt? Anyway, I get through the audition. Obviously, I wasn't being called, whatever, I leave. I'm walking down the street, please forgive me, Madeline. I'm walking down the street, and I hear these little footsteps behind me. And I turned around, and there was this lovely lady with a shawl around her, little ballet slipper feet, her hair pulled back in a ponytail, or a bun, might have been. And she said, I never do this, but I have to. Some actors are great actors, and they come in, they give terrible auditions. That happens. It happens. Some actors do that. Then there are actors who come and give great auditions and can never play the role. They're just not great actors, but they give great auditions. I never do this, please forgive me, but you're neither one of those. You have no talent. You have no talent whatsoever. You have nothing. You don't have a voice, you don't have a presence, you don't understand what it is to be on stage. I'm saving you years of misery. I never do this, please forgive me, but don't do this to yourself. Go off, do something else with your life. Do not waste your time. Less than a year later, I replaced her in a show. I replaced her in Circus, The Private Life of Jesus Christ. She was playing Our Ladies of 42nd Street, and I took over the role. It's lovely to see you, Natalie. But it's all in the book. And somebody that I just did an interview when I told that story, and I tell that story all the time. You're very, Natalie, if I had put your name in here, you could have sold a lot of copies of your book. New York Times bestseller. But how silly. But it's true, you know. He said, so why did you go on? You know, somebody says something like that to you, why did you go on? And the truth is, I don't know. I don't know why I was doing acting anyway. I didn't want to be an actor. I don't know why I wrote a play. I didn't want to be a playwright. But there were times when I was doing, I would do the 8 o'clock show at WPA, the 10 o'clock show at the Dove, the midnight show at La Mama, rehearse two other shows at the same time, do a show at Theater Genesis, do, you know, and the pay at the end of the week. $35 or $40 from all those companies put together, you got maybe $40 or nothing. And then you went to Phoebe's was a restaurant on the corner of 4th Street.
Yeah, Bowery and 4th.
And how do you know an actor from Phoebe's? Because they sit there the whole night drinking water, never ordering food, because they have no money for food. But at the end of the evening, taxi. They had money for a taxi, but never for food.
What do you miss about those days? Those days of La Mama in the
East Village? I don't miss anything. I'm still there. I'm still there. I mean, you know, you miss the people. Mm-hmm. The hardest part for me about all of my life, because of when I was a kid and all that, and Natalie will tell you this too, there was a lot of drugs, and we lost a lot of people to drugs. Then came AIDS, and we lost untold numbers to AIDS, and now there's old age. but that's what you miss. You miss the ones who are gone, who've left you, and were so much a part of your life, and you know, and that's what I said when I went to write the book. I asked Shirley MacLaine, because she's written 9 autobiographies. You know, she's had a lot of lives. And I said, Shirley, you would know better than anybody. Give me some advice how to do this. And she said, let your memory be your editor. Mm-hmm. What you remember, don't go digging. What you remember as it comes up, that's what you remember, and that's what's important. And I said, well, that's fine for me. I'll tell anything about myself. I don't care. I don't have any secrets. I have no ego about telling stories about myself. But there were a lot of dead people that I want to write about. And a lot of them were really young. They died when they were young and before they ever could have been who they should have been. And I feel a responsibility to tell their stories. But I want to, how do I make sure I'm not telling something they wouldn't want to tell? And she said, once again, it's your memory. You always, when you're writing, you're always writing about yourself. When you're writing this kind of stuff, you're always writing about yourself, even when you're writing about somebody else. It's how they affected you. It's the opposite of playwriting. In playwriting, you're constantly trying to push yourself out of it. If you hear your own voice and your own thoughts, you know you're doing it wrong. It has to be about the character. It has to be true to the character, the two characters. You know, I see a lot of bad plays where there's one character and then there's somebody to ask them questions, you know? And that's not how it's done. You've got to have real people that are, and they can't be the writer. They cannot be the writer. But this had to be, this had to have the feeling that I was telling you a story. And the other thing that I tried to make clear writing this was that I didn't judge myself, that I didn't say I was wrong or I was right, I should have done that, I shouldn't. I wanted the reader to make up their mind whether I was stupid to do that, I was right to do that. I wanted the reader to be able to read the book and say, this was the right thing to do, this is the wrong thing to do.
That was part of my conversation with 4-time Tony Award winner Harvey Fierstein about his new memoir, I Was Better Last Night. He joined us for our March in person, Get Lit with All of It book club event.
You are listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We continue our conversation with writer and actor Harvey Fierstein. His new memoir, I Was Better Last Night, was our March Get Lit with All of It selection. Thanks to our partners at the New York Public Library, 1,730 New Yorkers were able to check out an e-copy of the book and read along with us, and about 100 of you showed up to our in-person event. As usual, you came with great questions. Let's dive back into our event with Harvey Fierstein. In reading the book, I got the real sense that you don't give up on something if you really believe in it.
that you will just keep on going? Is that a matter of patience? Are you stubborn? Is it just you have a sense of, I'm going to do this and I'm going to see it through?
I don't believe in quitting. I don't mind failure. I really don't. Failure is horrible when it happens. I'm not even saying I look for failure. I do not look for failure. Mm-hmm. It's horrible when it happens. But failure plus time is really funny. You know, sometimes it can be really funny. It always makes a really interesting story. Failure, it makes, you know, is what makes us who we are. We don't get to be who we are from the compliments people give you. That's something you don't even try not to hear. Failure makes you who you are. So if something isn't going well, I will keep pushing until it goes. Because the one thing I can't live with, and the one thing I don't think any of us should ever live with, is that frustration feeling, that feeling that you didn't. You don't want to feel regret. Regret is a horrible feeling. I should have worked harder at that. Oh, I shouldn't have let him go. I should have. The should is a s***, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, that's what you don't want in your life. So you ask, why do I work so hard? I work so hard because there's nothing on the other end other than a learning experience. You're going to learn. You know, one of my teachers at Pratt that I hated would come up to your painting when you thought you'd finished, and he would slice it. And he said, there's no such thing as finished art. It's called painting, not painted. Didn't make my mother happy. She had a frame. She wanted to hang that.
You were very, very honest and open about alcohol addiction in the book and about getting sober. With hindsight, when you were drinking and drinking a lot, what did you think that was doing for you? You obviously did it because you thought it was helping you somehow. It just became a physical necessity at some point?
It was death. Mm-hmm. It was take me out. Mm-hmm. It was turn on the television, drink, numb. I can't anymore. That was the real feeling. Mm-hmm. The real feeling for those years was, I mean, it all blossomed into a suicide attempt. Mm-hmm. And the suicide attempt is the clearest because that's sort of the end of the drinking. Because as they say in 12-step, your alcohol just wants to get you in a room alone and kill you. That's the bottom line to it. But the feeling, the best I can describe it is, I've done it already. Mm-hmm. I fought every battle I can fight. I fought with this one. I've tried that. I had some good days. I had some bad days. I'm done. I've done it. Nobody can say I didn't try. Nobody can say I failed. Nobody can say anything. I did what I did, and now just leave me the f*** alone. And I just looked for that numb place. It came, of course, out of, I mean, now I understand, you know, I've been sober 26 years now. I now understand. If you lose that number of people that I was talking, I mean, it was 11 people from the company of Lacage, 7 from the company of Torch Song alone. Mm-hmm. Forget about your friends and everybody else you knew. It's just constant, you know, you spend your days fighting to get into a hospital room because they wouldn't let you in, just to climb into bed with somebody so that they didn't die without somebody touching them, when you have to fight a family that doesn't want them to stay in their apartment, want to throw them out on the street, when you have to fight to get somebody buried because no funeral home will touch the body, when you have to fight, I'd go on television and you know, a show like Nightline and fight with senators. Saying that we should lock up homosexuals, that if we put them all somewhere, then the rest of us will be safe. Mm-hmm. When you've lived and you fought that on a daily basis, when you've fought among yourselves as well, you had gay men saying, I'm not going to have safe sex. I fought too hard for the sexual revolution. I've won that. And now, you, we're not closing the baths. I'm keeping the baths open. I'll anyone I want now. When you've done that for enough years and you've fought all those battles and all that, you get a little tired of life. And I was there, and I didn't know what else to do with it. So I put on the television, and I drank. I drank half a gallon of 100-proof Southern Comfort a day.
Yeah.
I didn't have a solid bowel movement for a year. I didn't have feeling in my legs. I was developing gout. I was dead.
When did you know that you would make it through sobriety? I know it's a one-day-at-a-time process,
yeah, no,
but there must
be... even worse than that. It's simpler than that. What happened was I had a lover before all that happened who had gotten sober, and I, being the perfect lover, I went to Al-Anon. So I already had an Al-Anon background. I'd already been Al-Anon for 5 or 6 years, so I already knew what 12-step was. So I tried to commit suicide, woke up in the garage, only because I'm too stupid to realize how to do it right. Beyond words. But I woke up and went up to my bed, and when I woke up the next day, when I came out of the alcohol and the fumes from the car and all that stuff, I picked up the phone and I called one of my Al-Anon friends and said, get me to a meeting. So I was already surrendered. Mm-hmm. So it was like, it was the easiest thing I ever did, because it was over. For me, my life ended that night before, and my new life started that next day. And I have never looked back and tried to take control in that same way again. I've also looked at every day of my life since then as a gift, because I didn't earn any of these days. And I've looked at all of this as a gift, and I think my friends and all that see the difference in me also. Mm-hmm. I always was happy before, but now I'm really f***ing happy.
Let's take a few questions. In the back.
How are you? It's a pleasure to be in your presence. 3 days ago, our son was accepted to Pratt.
Talk to her.
I have a phone right here. If you have anything to say to him to save us $56,000 a year and shatter dreams.
Yeah, Mr. Mardigian is probably gone by now.
Okay, so...
I know people that came out of Pratt and had very good...
Because we're still waiting to hear from FIT. Should we hold on?
Is Pratt better now? I mean, I literally don't... They have a building in New York and everything.
Yeah. Thank you.
I mean, the neighborhood used to be so dangerous that we didn't dare leave school after dark. Now it's million dollar homes all around it. So things have changed. It's only been 100 years.
All right, let's get another question.
We have
in the back.
Right,
we have one in the back, and then we'll have someone come up in front.
I just so admire you. It's so great to be here.
Thank you.
I have an odd question. Do you have particular quilt patterns? I was so interested to know about your quilt. Do you do the log cabin? Do you do the
When I first learned, because I learned from one of those PBS shows, you know, one of those HGTV. When they first started, they used to have a quilting show, and that's how I learned to quilt. But then it became the love of fabric. I mean, any quilter, it's going to be the fat, you know. All we do is collect fabric. We'll never make quilts out of any of them, but we just buy fabric and buy fabric and buy fabric and buy fabric. I mean, if you saw my quilt tape, it's just a pile of... It's a terrible thing. But yeah, I love... Because what's great about a quilt, you make a painting and you give it to somebody, then they go, oh, I got to hang that up whenever you... You know, it's like, where the... I'm going to put that painting, just stick it in the closet. When he comes to dinner, we'll hang it up. But a quilt, you know, you have two sides, so it doubles the chance you might like one of them. And if you don't, the dog can sleep on it. You can always take the leaves from the dining room table and wrap them up in it. I mean, there's always a room for a quilt. There's always a reason to have a quilt. People love quilts.
We had a question down front.
Hi, it's so great to be here. How do you, I just finished the book, it's fabulous. There's a lot of Jewish references throughout the book. So how would you define Judaism in your life, in the present, in the past? Has it evolved? How do you define yourself, if you do at all? You know, you're obviously, you admit you're Jewish. A lot of people don't. You do. You seem proud. I don't want to answer the question because I'm asking it, but what? How does it define you? How would you say it's part of your life now?
Well, I'm an atheist, so to me, being Jewish has absolutely nothing to do with religion. But I always, you know how Jews are. If you had four rabbis in a room, one of them would be an atheist. It's just the way Jews are. They need something to fight about, to argue over. No, Jewish is one of those things you can't get. It's a way of thinking. Well, it's also a race. Like Benzers, but it's a race. You know, there's a line in the book saying, you know, I grew up in this neighborhood where the Jews tentatively befriended the Italians, who tentatively befriended the Greeks, and we went about our day never realizing that we lived on the edge of a country that did not consider us white. And that's what being Jewish was. I was born in 52, which is only a few years after the war. I grew up with people with numbers tattooed on their arms. These, I knew. There are stories in the book, as you know, of my relatives going to try and bring people back from Europe. And this one story, they sent one of my great uncles with money, one of the Schatzbergs, to go bring back people. And he came back with no one. And they said, you couldn't find any relatives? He said, just women. Not worth bringing back. So being Jewish... Nothing binds you together like being murdered together. Is there a nicer way to say that? I have on the walls in my house armbands with Jewish stars, armbands with pink triangles, because both of my people were murdered. And it's a way of thinking, you know? It's like, hey, you know, Jews have a way of thinking. I don't know why. The silliness of our religion, I don't know. Religion's also silly. But this friend that I just met that I haven't seen since fifth grade, nice Jewish boy who's the head of a sect for Jews for Jesus. You know? And it's like, I never had. It's like, that's what you believe, Stephen. Fine. It's just fine with me. I mean, but he's still a Jew. There's no way he can get rid of being a Jew. You know?
Let's get one more question in.
Thank you. Hi. I work with Latino artists, and I loved your insight about exploring new opportunities. What guidance or counsel do you have for artists who have problems letting go? Like pursuing a profession, it's not working for them, but they're intent on doing it as opposed to exploring something new.
That's so individual. It's so individual. I mean, my darling Natalie here, if I had listened to Natalie, I'm going to be 70 in a couple of weeks. I would be a retired school teacher probably going to Miami. So if Natalie had her way, I'd be in Miami now. I'll buy you lunch. But I'm saying you can't control... When it comes to art, you can't control the passion in a person. You can tell them they suck. You can tell them anything you want if it's in you and it's built. Like I said, I never wanted to be an actor. I never wanted to be a writer. I didn't think I was a great artist. I wanted to be around artistic people. I wanted that energy. And that energy became what it became. So you don't have to be great. You don't have to be the greatest thing. One of the other students that we went to school with, I wrote a children's book called The Sissy Duckling, which HBO bought and made a movie of. And they hired the number one animation designer in the country to design the characters. We went to high school together. His name was Daniel Haskett. And Daniel and I were sitting there. I start crying to think about this. Daniel and I are sitting there, they're recording the songs for the special, for the HBO special. and was sitting there with Dionne Warwick recording our songs for us. This very poor Jewish kid, this black kid from the Bronx, he's number one in his field. I'm doing okay in my field. I said, Daniel, we have Dionne Warwick working for us. We have Dionne Warwick working for us. Walk on by my. I mean, who would predict something like that would ever happen, right? And yet it does. It does. You believe. We're going to have this artist coming up who has a story very much like that. A love and a talent that cannot be denied. A personality that cannot be denied. And that's the way it works, is it not?
It is.
That was my conversation with Harvey Fierstein about his new memoir, I Was Better Last Night, from our March Get Lit with All of It book club event. It was our first in-person event we've had in more than 2 years. And that voice you heard faintly at the very end belonged to our event's special guest, Titus Burgess, who was selected by Harvey to join us for the evening.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.